The Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood will come to order.
Ouch.
Sorry,
man.
I'm right-handed, and I tried to do it with the
man,
left hand.
She got me.
Let me see.
Did you just
declaw Senator Olson? That's right.
Okay, with that.
Actually, he was declawed last November, I believe.
Yeah. And now we have music. Great. I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill. We're going to do two quick work sessions and then move into the one public hearing we have for today. So I'm opening up a work session on House Bill 2889A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2889A was previously heard on the 7th of this month. It's the one that directs the Department of Human Services to permit and monitor savings accounts for children under age 12 or older in DHS custody via rulemaking. It entitles children in DHS custody for 6 months or more to assistance establishing savings accounts, prohibits DHS or other legal guardian from establishing accounts on behalf of the child, allows DHS to monitor use of the child's money relating to state and federal benefits. There's a -A7 amendment, which removes the requirement that DHS actively encourage use of savings account, clarifies that the assistance establishing accounts is to be provided by DHS, adds provisions establishing the child's capacity to contract, enabling financial institutions to permit youth to make deposits and withdrawals and to rely on the youth signatures, and also removes references to child care agencies and foster parents. There is a minimal revenue on the A7 and no fiscal.
Thank you. Representative or Senator Olson. I'm so sorry.
He's not here. He's on the other side.
I know. He just kind of gets under your skin that way.
He's got a broken finger. Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the -A7 amendments dated 5/22/2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the -A7 amendments dated 5/22/2015. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, the only thing I'd say, it would always be nice to have a name on an amendment, wouldn't it? Thank you.
All right. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move House Bill 2889A as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2889A as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I just want to thank those that have worked so hard on this to get it just right. This is a great opportunity for young people, so thank you to everyone that has worked on it, and especially to the young people that spent a lot of time in the Capitol working on this bill.
They did really good.
And Madam Chair, I said it gave me great pleasure to see the first time this concept came out during the summer as it moved through the legislature, and now it's taken a couple of weeks longer, so it's been 2 weeks more pleasure for me. So I thank those of you who delayed this.
And, Madam Chair, I've heard that Senator Denbrough, to everyone that wants to open a savings account, has got a $10 bill for them.
Madam Chair,
Senator Cruz wants to open a savings account now.
I'm just kind of trying to figure out what Senator Denbrough's definition of pleasure is, but that's a whole other issue.
You know, at this point in the session, it doesn't take much.
No, that's true.
I think it's time to move on.
It is. Okay.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Motion
yes.
passes, and it goes to the floor. Senator Olson, will you please carry?
Absolutely.
Thank
Love
you
to.
Very much. All right, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2889A, open up a work session on House Bill 2890A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2890A is the second of the two bills that were brought by the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, and this is the one that directs Department of Human Services to provide for participation in extracurricular activities for children in its care and coordinating in coordination with agencies and foster parents. It defines extracurricular activities and reasonable and prudent parenting standards. There is a -A4 amendment. It's changing church activities and religious activities so that they both consistently say religious services. The exception to extracurricular activities so that religious services alone don't satisfy the requirement. This was no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the A4, and previously heard on May 7th.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the -A4 amendment dated 5/12/2015.
Vice Chair Olson moves to adopt the -A4 amendments dated 5/12/2015. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, the only thing I'd be concerned about, and I hope it's in here, is that those people that are going to be foster parents are aware that this is a necessity. I would hope they would be, because I'd hope they treat those children just like their own. But I want to make sure that DHS make certain that they cover those bases that, you know, hey, boy or girl wants to play soccer, you know, you need to make accommodations for that. I think most parents would, but we heard cases where they wouldn't, and that's why we're here. And this is really good.
Thank you very much. Is there any further discussion on the amendments? Is there any objection to the amendments? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Gilster, I move House Bill 2890A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson moves House Bill 2890A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I've been involved in the foster care system in this building for a long, long time, trying to make it better. And this is one of those subtle little things that I think is way bigger than we probably realize right now. This is an incredibly good bill. I'm very happy to see us doing this.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. The bill goes to the floor, and I will carry this one. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2890A and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3494A. Cheyenne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3494A prohibits devocalization and or declawing of cats or dogs except under specified circumstances. This measure came out of House Committee unanimously and off the House floor 35-18. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal.
Representative Brent Barton and Representative David Gomberg, please.
Oh, my apologies, Madam Chair. There is a dash A5 amendment as well. It broadens the applicability of the measure to more animals and prohibits procedures outright unless they're medically necessary.
Welcome, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent Oregon House District 40. I'm here today to testify in support of the bill in front of you. I'd like to outline essentially at a high level what the bill does, and then I'd like to talk about some of the arguments we've heard against it. And there are really two primary arguments we've heard against it, which I, at the risk of oversimplifying, I will describe as from the right and from the left. Now, what the bill does, the committee administrator described it well. It essentially adopts restrictions to try and limit and ultimately prohibit, except under certain circumstances, two procedures. The devocalization of dogs, which is a barbaric and antiquated procedure that's rarely done anymore, I'm pleased to say, in which that's literally, it's what it sounds like. A veterinarian will literally go in and cut the vocal cords of a dog, prohibiting loud barking. Again, it is a barbaric procedure. It has a lot of effects, both physical and psychological, on dogs, and is rarely done. I'm pleased to say I myself have never actually known a debarked dog. But still, several other states have banned this practice. I believe Maryland, Massachusetts, I think one other state did. Oregon will join that list, and that part of the bill has attracted little attention or controversy. The other part of the bill is been a little more contentious, has to do with the restriction of the declawing of cats. Now, on a personal level, some of you have been to my office before. In fact, I think a majority of this committee has. You will have noticed the portrait of my cat. In fact, several of them in my office. It's an object of great mirth to my colleagues in the House how much I love my stupid cat. And I call him a stupid cat because, indeed, he's not the brightest little fellow. But I love him dearly. Clarence is his name. So the declawing of cats is, unlike the debarking of dogs, it is unfortunately a very common procedure. It is all too common, in my opinion. It is, in my opinion, a barbaric procedure. It is terrible for cats, and I would like to see the day when it will no longer be done in this country, as is the case in many other states, many other countries, excuse me. No state has adopted a statewide prohibition or restriction on the decline of dogs. This bill, as presented, is a modest first step in that direction. It does contain a number of exemptions that are contained within the Oregon, the veterinary guidelines at a national level. So that's what this bill does. Now, there have been basically two categories of arguments against it, from what I will describe as from the right and from the left. The argument from the right is why we could barely get this through the House. It is responsible for most of the no votes and most of the opposition to this. It is essentially a libertarian argument. It essentially is arguing that this is not something that the state should get involved in, that this is up to individual pet owners and their veterinarians, and this is not not fair game for legislative action. You know, I simply think that this this procedure is so bad for cats, so bad for most animals, that it is an appropriate topic of legislative action. It is. I've known too many declawed cats. It has a lot of implications for those animals long term, and I just at the end of the line, if the couch is more important than the animal, then you should not be a cat owner, is my opinion. So that is my rebuttal, personally, to kind of the libertarian argument about why this appropriate topic for state action. And again, that was responsible for the no votes in the House and the close votes margin. Now, the argument which I call from the left didn't peel off any no votes in the House, but it is responsible for cluttering of your inboxes by email, and I apologize for that. I appreciate your indulgence on this. It's an issue near and dear to my heart. That argument is essentially that this bill does not go far enough, that this bill does contain a number of exemptions, some of which are quite broad, and that by enacting those exemptions, it legitimizes this inhumane practice. And on a personal level, I'm not unsympathetic to this argument. Again, the purpose of the reason I brought this bill forward is I am fundamentally hostile to the decline of cats. Having said that, that kind of all-or-nothing approach is a luxury that we legislators seldom enjoy. I was perhaps restricted to all that we could get through the legislative chamber, all we could get through the House, and we simply couldn't get any bill through over the opposition of the veterinarians. As it is, the veterinarians are neutral on this bill. They have been on this bill, as in many other animal bills, great partners to work with, and I appreciate their assistance. But even still, we could barely get it through the House. So although this bill does not go as far as some would like, indeed, as I would perhaps like, this is a strong first step. It is would make it already the most restrictive of any state in the union. And I think more than that, it, as I think Sharon Harmon from the Oregon Humane Society will talk about later, this law, first of its kind, really provides an opportunity to educate the public and the veterinary community about some of the bad effects that the decline of cats does, that this is not just a routine medical procedure, that this is something that really should only be done as a last resort. And anyway, that's the direction I'd like to move in. This is the best we can do this session, but I would really appreciate your support. Again, will it go further? I look forward to the day when it does, and this practice is is almost unheard of in the United States as it is in many European countries. But unfortunately, today it's all too common. Thank you for the hearing, and again, colleagues, I apologize for cluttering your inboxes.
Thank you, Mr. Representative. Mr. Representative. Thank you, Representative.
Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon Coast, and Representative Barton is the PAC leader on this particular piece of legislation. But I had a few things that I wanted to add to the conversation. As you may know, this legislation started out as a landlord-tenant issue. That landlords could not require potential tenants to debark their dogs or declaw their cats before they could actually rent an apartment or lease a property. And the deeper that the committee and the people involved in the legislation got into it, the more horrible they realized the subject matter was that they were discussing, which was why you ended up with a bill that was not about landlord-tenant relations, but about dogs and cats. So let's not sanitize the subject matter by calling it debarking and declawing. I mean, let's call it what it is. A debarking is surgically cutting the vocal cords of dogs. And declawing is not trimming the nails of cats. It is amputating the paws of cats, amputating. And I want to talk first of all about declawing, because it is, the documentation is clear that it's painful, and of course it is permanent, and it is prevalent. I myself, my wife and I have owned cats that we rescued that came to us declawed. Now, understand that when you declaw a cat, most often you only declaw the front paws, so the back claws are still intact. Understand that there are a number of alternatives to declawing, which could include trimming nails or even super gluing rubber pads onto the claws of cats, which is fairly common. But what we do when we declaw a cat in the short term, putting it through this painful process, in the long term, altering its lifestyle and removing one of its main defensive mechanisms. I live in the country. The first cat that we had was declawed, didn't come home one night. Most likely didn't come home because it was unable to protect itself in the outside. And we're very, very cautious about trying to bring our animals in the evening, but sometimes animals have their way, and sometimes they want to enjoy the evening, as sometimes we do ourselves, and sometimes they don't come home. So it's a permanent process, and I understand the people that are writing to you and saying we need to ban this outright because it's a barbaric practice. In the case of debarked dogs, dogs that have had their vocal cords cut, Representative Barton indicated he doesn't know, hasn't met such a dog. I will tell you that we have a rescue dog that was debarked. And again, a painful process, not a permanent process. I would say that that our debarked dog is as loud as any dog in the neighborhood right now, because it simply doesn't take, it doesn't hold. And there are a multitude of reasons why most veterinarians will no longer debark dogs. An increasing number of veterinarians who won't apply the practice, except for the health of the animal. An increasing number of veterinarians that won't declaw their cats. Again, for some of the reasons that you have heard about in detail. So we have a bill before you that I believe is going to take a major and very positive step and send a very clear message. I know you've also got some amendments before you. I will simply say that debarking and declawing are bad things, that I believe this committee will do a good thing here, and no matter what you decide, we will either be happy to see the bill passed or fight very hard for concurrence if you send it back to us.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel?
Yes, I have one.
Senator Olson.
How does your bill relate to taking the dew claws off of Labradors or bigger animals that typically have their dew claws removed?
Chair Gelster and Vice Chair Olson, off the top of my head, I don't believe it relates to the decline of dogs as currently drafted. It's only decline of cats and the debarking of dogs. If
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's possible I misread that, but off the top of my head, I don't believe it does. It's a question that had not come up previously.
Senator Monis Anderson.
Oh, well, I just want you to know where I'm coming from. I'm coming from as a nurse who has their own association and their own board, who has standards of care that are set up by the association, and then if there are complaints, they go to the board. And when I think of veterinarians, I believe that they're as well trained as a nurse. They are as ethically responsible as a nurse, and they have a unique provider-client relationship. And we are telling them what their standards of care should be. And I want you to know, I have issues with that. So do you have a response or not?
Chair Gelser and Senator Monis Anderson, I understand. And, you know, one of the things that I think is great about Oregon, we of course do several animal bills each session. In many states, my understanding is that the Veterinarian Association and lobbyists and the kind of what I'll call animal advocates sometimes have a contentious relationship, which I think most would agree is counterproductive. In Oregon, we've worked well together, and they really have been good partners in this bill. And perhaps, again, my response to some of the people who feel this bill does not go far enough is that we have an ongoing relationship with the veterinarians here, and they have been good partners in this, and they've helped us craft this bill. They are neutral in the bill. They are not opposed to it, which is indeed the only reason why we could get it through the House. I think at first they were very suspicious. They didn't like, you know, a professional kite flyer and a lawyer telling them how to practice veterinary medicine. They didn't appreciate the idea of the legislature telling them how to practice veterinary medicine. However, I think just in the way that they've been engaged throughout this process, that this bill is acceptable to them, at least to the extent they're neutral. I saw that at least some of them are signed up to testify, and they can perhaps
ask
questions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Sorry. Senator Olson.
No, thank you. I think you're going to call Representative. I want to get back to my dew claw question because I had to look at the bill to make sure. You define in the bill as an animal on line 6 as a means a dog or a cat. And then on line 7, you define a claw as a hardened
keratinized, what's it, keratinized, I guess that modification of the epidermis, or a hardened keratinized growth extending from the end of the digits or of certain mammals, blah, blah, blah. And then 10, on line 10, it says declaw means to remove or to prevent the normal function of a claw of an animal by surgical procedure. What?
But on page 2, it goes to the person may not declaw a cat.
I'm not talking about a cat. I'm talking about you've got an animal defined as a dog. And oftentimes, dew claws are taken off of dogs. So I'm just wondering if this bill would allow that process to go on, because the dew claws is the one way up here high, and it usually gets hooked on stuff and gets ripped out. And typically on young puppies, they do it right away so that it doesn't hurt them.
And I think it wouldn't impact that, because the only prohibition, it comes on line 2 on page 2, and it just says a person may not declaw a cat. So even though it defined what decline was.
I'm talking about a dog.
Right, but the bill doesn't talk about decline a dog. It only talks about decline a cat. So it defines claw, it defines declaw, it defines animal, but then when you get into what the bill does,
the only thing we can declaw is a cat.
The only thing you can't declaw is a cat. Does that make sense?
Okay, that makes sense. Just want to make sure, because that is on bigger dogs, that's a problem that they do all the time.
And Chair Gelser, just for purposes of the legislative history, that's my reading of the bill as well. That's my intent. But I will take a second look at it just to make sure. But I believe that this would only apply to decline of cats.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, if I could further clarify, the medical necessity could also arguably apply to the case of a dew claw that's getting caught and snagged, that a veterinarian recommends.
I want to make sure that that's covered.
Are there further questions for this panel? Seeing them, will you, either of you, be able to stay around for the rest of the testimony in case we have further questions?
I'd be happy to, Chair Gelson.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much. All right, next we have Laura Cochrane, Michelle Nagel-Schneider, and Jim Ginsvold. And you can all three come up at the same time. So, Laura, is it Michelle or Michael? Michelle and Jim. Great. Thank you. Welcome.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. Excuse me. My name is Laura Cochrane, and I'm a veterinarian in Portland. I'm also the Oregon director for the PAW Project, which, as you hopefully know, is the world's largest organization devoted solely to ending the practice of declawing. I'm here today to urge you to oppose HB 3494A. The exceptions for last resort and protection of human health are loopholes that will only allow declawing and devocalization to continue as usual. As written, this is an unenforceable ban. The same excuses currently used by both pet owners and veterinarians to perform these in the first place are going to be given legitimacy. These are invasive convenience procedures with no medical benefit to the animal. I ask that you only accept legislation as presented in the A5 amendment that prohibits these surgeries except to treat a physical ailment of the animal, nothing else. If we know that decline and devocalization are wrong, why would we allow this bill to legitimize it? And in reference to Representative Barton's testimony, I just wanted to point out that the 8 cities in California that have a complete ban with no exceptions, I know it's 8 cities, it's not the whole state, but those 8 cities have a combined population of people and animals that far exceeds the entire state of Oregon. So we're talking about a large population of people. That's pretty significant. And the New York ban being considered right now on decline is a complete ban with no exceptions. And just like the other countries around the world where this is illegal, no exceptions. And just a reminder, there are people in these other places, whether it be a city in California or another country, that have expensive furniture, that are on blood thinners, that have thin skin, that have HIV. They don't even consider decline as an option, and it's working. And you say this is a first step, but what is the next step? You really think it's going to lead anywhere? I'm really curious how and what the plan is. And you're going to hear today from those in favor of the current language of this bill that argue we must keep decline as an option to keep cats in homes. If it were true that declawing keeps cats in homes and from being relinquished, then no declawed cats would end up in the shelters. And I did a quick search on petfinder.com last night, and it showed that within 100 miles of Salem, there are 33 cats that are declawed up for adoption. The number's actually probably higher because municipal shelters don't usually report on the Petfinder site. So why aren't these 33 cats in their homes? The Humane Society of the United States, the Humane Society Veterinary Medical Association, and Alley Cat Allies are all national organizations that support complete bans on declawing. They also want to keep cats in their homes. If these groups really thought that declawing would keep cats in their homes, as veterinary medical associations like the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association are going to claim it does, then why would they support a complete ban? So the last resort exception that's in the current version, my question, how are you going to know if, in fact, the veterinarian has tried everything? How will it be documented? How many attempts? What sort of proof? Behavior changes are not an overnight fix. Taking a proper history of the issue, counseling the owner about the time involved in successful behavior modification, this is how we change behaviors. Given that over 150 veterinary clinics in Oregon currently offer declawing, and that's on the OVMA website, and just so you know, over 30 offer debarking, do you really think that trying everything will suddenly become the preferred route? And just so you know, any member of the community who searches for a vet clinic on the OVMA website, there's a drop-down menu with search parameters. You can actually click decline or debarking as a way to find the clinic that you want. The exact exemptions that you propose are already clearly stated in the AVMA, that's the American Veterinary Medical Association's policy on declawing. Yet approximately 25% of cats in the United States are declawed. Sadly, there are even many vets who routinely supersize kitten spay-neuter surgeries to include declawing. How can you tell me that all attempts have failed? And most of these kittens being declawed, the problem behavior the vet is supposed to be correcting hasn't even had a chance to develop. These vets are going against the AVMA's policy, and there's absolutely no way to police this, just as there will be no way to regulate an Oregon law with the same exceptions. And it's also interesting that just a few days ago, the website of the largest humane group in Oregon did state that although it opposed declawing, and I quote, if you decide to have your cat declawed, we suggest that you have the surgery done at the time she's spayed or neutered. Now, I know this has since been taken down when we alerted them to this, but again, before you even give these kittens a chance to succeed at using scratching posts or nail caps, you're saying go ahead and declaw them anyway while they're already under anesthesia? I just don't understand that a humane organization would even say this. You're also going to hear the tired argument that veterinarians need to have the option to declaw because there could be potential health concerns to the owner if they were to be scratched. Honestly, it seems like the only people who are making this argument are the veterinarians who are making the money doing this procedure. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control, the NIH, National Institute of Health, Infectious Diseases Society of America, and the U.S. Public Health Service have published statements saying that declawing cats is not recommended to prevent transmission of disease from cats to people, even the most immunocompromised of people, those living with HIV. There is no evidence that declawing is significantly effective in protecting human health. In fact, nearly all feline diseases that may be spread from cats to immunocompromised people are not spread by scratching. They're spread by biting. And guess what? Declawed cats are more likely to bite and thus pose a greater risk. So why are veterinarians grasping onto the false claim that declawing is needed to protect human health? I'm going to have to side with the human health organizations that are true experts on the issue. And isn't it inappropriate for veterinarians to make recommendations on human health affairs when it goes against organizations like the CDC and the NIH? HB 3494A is not a first step to helping animals. It is not a first step to future legislation to increase protection of animals in Oregon. There will be no will by lawmakers to pass stronger legislation in the near future. If there were, why not just do it now? unless it's amended to remove the loopholes, it is only a first step to wider public acceptance of two inhumane convenience surgeries. In order for this bill to actually protect animals, the exceptions need to be removed. The exceptions are not based in fact. I respectfully ask that you please reject HB 3494A in its current unamended form and either withdraw it or amend it so that it accomplishes a meaningful regulation of decline and devocalization in Oregon. The only ethical reason to surgically alter the paws or the vocal cords is to treat a physical ailment of the animal. All eyes are on Oregon to be a leader and a champion for the animals. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you.
Okay.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Senator Gelser and the rest of the committee. For the record, my name is Michelle Nagel-Schneider, and I have the Cat Behavior Clinic in Portland for the last 20 years, and I also have a book on cat behavior. And most of our clients who want to declaw their cats come to us so they don't have to declaw them. And most of them want to declaw their cats. And I don't even want to use the word declaw because it's a fancy way to say amputation. We don't delimb ourselves. We amputate, and it is an amputation. They come to us because they want to save their furniture. What Dr. Cochran mentioned, it's so rare for me in my 20 years of doing this to hear that we have an immunocompromised person that's worried about their cat scratching them and having a disease or a sickness. What we do see with declaws are our clients that come to us, their cats are already declawed. Their cats can tend to bite more. The aftercare of the declaw surgery, we often see litter box issues develop, and this is why millions of cats are euthanized in the shelters. Cats that are sent to the shelters, a third of them are there for behavior issues, and the number one being litter box issues. And when cats are not able to claw mark to mark territory, they often will urine mark, which is to cat owners, for some reason in their mind, a worse problem, even though it's still urine. It's urine marking. So behaviorally, I think it's inhumane to have cats declawed. Dr. Dodman, who is a board-certified vet behaviorist at Cornell, he said that it was so obvious after the declaws were done on cats in veterinary hospitals, they actually used to test different analgesic or pain medications on these cats to see which one would help these cats stay out of pain. And I don't think it's routine that they use pain medication for cats after declaw surgery, or they don't do it long enough, because an amputation on all their digits, I would think weeks of pain medication. So physically it's inhumane. I was a veterinary assistant 20 years ago, and I saw out of all the surgeries, this was the worst one. These cats would wake up, pull their bandages off, and we as technicians would come in the morning, there'd be blood all over the walls and ceilings of their stainless steel cages, and really painful for these cats. And of course, no one would tell the owners this. So my feeling on this bill is that it should be banned. 20 other more enlightened countries have banned declaw, saying it is very inhumane. And I think that if we take the stance and ban it altogether, cat owners would search for ways to address this problem, the decline problem of their furniture. And it is actually, in addition to being inhumane, it's not necessary, because it is, I think, one of the easier problems to solve behaviorally. I just think we're still a little bit in the dark ages. There's a lot of behavior modification out there for dogs, and cat owners just don't know what's out there. And I think if they didn't have the option of decline, then they would search out ways to effectively get rid of that problem. So I'm hoping that we can end this exemption in the bill. I just think it should be banned, definitely. It would be the most humane thing to do.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Jim Jensvold. I am the assistant director of the PAW Project. I grew up in Linn County, but I don't live in Oregon anymore. I think Dr. Cochran was very thorough in the opinion and the position of the PAW project. I just would like to say that I was very happy to hear Mr. Barton, and Representative Barton and Representative Gomberg speak. I think we're probably in 90%+ agreement with them. I want to just offer myself, if indeed you had any questions about our experience in passing anti-declaw legislation in the state of California and in cities in California, because these exact exceptions that are in this bill as written now are ones that we dealt with in many cities and in the state of California. And if we thought this really was a first step, we understand the need to compromise in the political process. We've had to do that before. And if I really thought this was a first step, a meaningful first step to banning declawing or ending declawing. In fact, banning declawing is probably what we don't really care to do. We just want people not to want to do it. It'd be better if not to have a law. But in California, we found that there wasn't the will to do that, so we needed to make it a law. The one thing I will do, besides offer myself for questions, is repeat something Dr. Cochran said, and that is, we really truly don't feel this is a first step to ending declawing. We think it is a first step to a wider public acceptance of these two procedures that are described by Mr. Barton as inhumane and barbaric, and we don't think it's going to end them. We think this legislation could be used as model legislation in other jurisdictions, in other states, and if it did so, then it could actually set back our efforts to end declawing for decades, perhaps. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Senator Olson.
Doctor, what are the current laws in our state? As a veterinarian, you would probably understand them, what you can and can't do.
The current laws about declawing or devocalization?
Yes.
There aren't any.
None whatsoever?
No. The OVMA has a position statement, but they're not the governing body.
So, follow up. So if someone comes in and says, I want to have my cat declawed, it's up to your discretion whether you will do that procedure or not.
Exactly,
and
yes.
They could hunt for any number of veterinarians to have that done.
They could, and I think it's our job as veterinarians to give them every humane option. I mean, the unfortunate thing is that a lot of veterinarians don't really receive much training or education in behavior. And there was a study actually that showed only 11% of vets thought that it was their responsibility to initiate discussion about behavior. Behavior is one of the things I get asked the most about, behavior and nutrition, and those are the two things that in vet school we get the least training on. So I think for a lot of veterinarians, there is that incentive that to go with what they know, which is surgery, and not even take the time. In many cases, I've heard many vets that don't even offer, you know, to talk about horizontal versus vertical scratching and substrates of what they like to scratch. I mean, it's something that I find that people are very receptive to, but as we as veterinarians are looked to as the authority figure on this, and so many of us aren't even taking that opportunity, then I mean, vets are still going to be, these 150-plus clinics that are listed on the site, what's going to make them suddenly want to try everything other than surgery?
Follow up? A question that I've received much information on, that if a cat is declawed, it has a propensity not to use its litter box anymore. Is that correct or not?
Cats who are declawed and say they come home and they're put in their litter pan, it hurts. And so they develop a litter box aversion, pain. And so they, I think up to, is it 15% of those cats? I have the information. Yeah, up to 15% will develop house soiling after declawing. So it's basically in their mind. They come home, they use this, you know, their feet hurt. And I agree. I mean, most veterinarians don't use nearly enough pain control, even though we're just talking about the post-operative period, not the long-term effects. But they're going to then associate that litter box with pain, and then they're going to go elsewhere. And it may happen immediately. It may happen down the road. I've seen cats who end up having regrowth of the third bone that's not removed entirely, and it's like walking on pebbles, and then that's painful, and then they develop the aversion because of the pain. So, yeah, we see, I mean, the study that I'm looking at, it says up to 15% will develop house soiling from that litter box aversion.
Follow up. Sir, you had mentioned that this could be, the original bill could be a outline for further laws down the road that would prevent would cause more declawing. Why do you say that?
Well, I don't necessarily... I wouldn't necessarily state it would cause more declawing, but it could prevent the cessation of declawing in other jurisdictions. We had a bill, the bill that was originally introduced, the landlord bill, was a bill that we developed in California in 2010. It was passed in 2012, and that bill was, the language was lifted. Actually, we gave it to the HSUS rep, I think that was the basis of the original language of this bill. Now it's become something else. But that bill also was, the language was lifted from California, and it was a bill was passed in Rhode Island, now law. Same language was lifted and introduced in New York and Massachusetts. Those bills are pending. So we know that that's how it happens. And so if a bill looks like it's good model legislation, it's taken and transplanted and across the country. And I think that there's a chance that that's what happened.
Follow up. Why do you think that this original legislation, the A of 3494, why do you think it will not be sufficient to do what it was supposed to do in our state?
The original bill?
Yes.
The landlord bill?
No, the original, the A engrossed House Bill 3494.
Because it allows exceptions that are already the AVMA guidelines for practice. And if vets are already following AVMA guidelines, then this bill is superfluous. And it's solely at the discretion of the vet. So any vet, by the way, I'm not a veterinarian. I'm an oral surgeon. So I know what you're talking about with nursing. You know, veterinary profession, nursing profession, we don't like to be regulated or told what to do because we think we know better than anybody. And I think the vets who are keen on doing this procedure, this bill allows them to do it.
What are the consequences for violating the guidelines of the American Veteran?
There's nothing.
So this would be an improvement then, in that not following the guidelines would then make the person violating state law.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Oh, that's fine.
I'm not sure. To me, it looks like it's not particularly enforceable. I don't know what the mechanism for enforcement would be. It looks like if I were an oral surgeon, which I am, who wanted to get around a prohibition on removing wisdom teeth, which I do, I do the procedure, then I would make sure I had it fully documented that there was a legitimate reason for doing it. And I think any vet that really was keen on doing it would do the same thing.
Were there questions?
Just one, and this may be off the wall, but I'm thinking now of my brother, who thinks it's inhumane to neuter a dog or a cat. And I don't know if there's a correlation between the two, but I think there are procedures that we do that are in the best interests of the health and safety, I would hope. That would be the only reason for the health and safety of the animal.
I would answer that as a former commissioner on the Los Angeles Animal Services Board, and we had to deal with euthanasia, and there is a nationwide, as far as I know, it's a problem in Oregon too of pet overpopulation, and spaying and neutering helps the population of pets by reducing the number so they find homes. I think that's a significant difference between the declawing and devocalization issues.
One follow-up question. Doctor, the A5 amendment, are you okay with that?
The one that was proposed?
Yes.
I'm okay if the word physical is put in front of there needs to be in front of to relieve an illness, disease, or injury. It needs to be a physical illness, disease, or injury.
We'd prefer it.
That's
in front of where?
C, the procedure is medically necessary to treat or relieve an illness, disease, or injury, or to correct a congenital abnormality. It should say, for completeness, to relieve a physical illness, disease, or injury.
There's a reason for that, if anyone's interested.
In that being?
Because in other jurisdictions, that was used as a loophole. It said they had to devocalize animals for mental problems.
Any other questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, next we have Sarah Wood and Brian Kuzmich. Never say your name the right way, Brian. I'm sorry.
No, that's OK.
Yes, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm here not representing anyone but myself as a concerned citizen and a former veterinary technician. Thank you for allowing me to speak today regarding Oregon Bill HB 3494A, allowing exceptions that are giant loopholes that will allow vets to continue declawing cats. I've driven down from Portland today to make my voice heard, to speak for those who can't. As a retired veterinary technician, I can attest to seeing all kinds of problems resulting from cat declaws.
And Sarah, did you say your name for the record?
Sarah Wood.
Okay, thank you.
Infected paws, biting, and other changes to the animal's behavior and well-being. In Europe, the practice of declawing is illegal and considered inhumane and often referred to as torture. It is amputation. It is not a convenient solution to having a couch and having a leather couch and a cat. Animals are a privilege, not a right. If someone doesn't love an animal enough to live with the fact that it is indeed an animal and animals have claws, they should not have an animal. A cat's claws are not only their first line of defense against predators, but are a necessity to aid in jumping, stretching, and general balance. Taking a cat's claws away takes away their security and strips them of their ability to escape from predators. Imagine that. Cats will often resort to biting as a way to protect themselves. Then they end up in a shelter deemed a bad or an aggressive cat. Imagine the pain of having the tips of your fingers cut off for a second. Now imagine having to use those aching, swollen, bloody paws to scratch around in your litter box when you have to go to the bathroom. You wouldn't want to be touched again. That human that you trusted removed you from your safe home and had the tips of your fingers chopped off so they could save their couch. Of course, you would be miserable and sad. Then you'd end up in a shelter. It doesn't seem fair. Any law allowing mutilation of an animal is only a legal form of animal abuse. This bill, if used as a model legislation, could invalidate the anti-declaw laws in place and set back the efforts to effect real change and end declawing. It is not our right as humans to alter our pets for convenience. Animals save lives, detect cancer, soothe our stress. They deserve our respect. An animal is an animal, and if you don't want to live with an animal, don't have one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Brian Posowitz. I'm here on behalf of a new organization called Humane Oregon. Humane Oregon was formed last year to help promote animal welfare in Oregon's political process and elections. Humane Oregon opposes the current form of House Bill 3494. However, we would support the bill if the Dash 5 amendments were adopted. And I should say we would also support the change about adding the modifier physical that you heard in the earlier testimony. We agree with those who say that devocalizing and declawing are inhumane procedures. They deprive the animals of a basic part of their identities, and they lead to other. They may lead to other physical and behavioral problems. We believe these procedures should be performed only if it's medically necessary for the animal or if it's truly a last resort situation, a last resort to euthanasia. We appreciate the good intentions in the engrossed version of the bill. We appreciate the broad statement to attempt to limit devocalization and decline. However, we think the exceptions to the general rule are just way too broad. And to be specific, the bill would allow devocalization upon a showing only that, quote, behavioral modification to correct excessive vocalization has failed. It would allow decline upon a showing only that, quote, attempts to prevent the animal from destructively using its claws have failed. These terms are undefined, and they could mean something as minimal as just telling the animal a couple of times to stop barking or to stop scratching the couch, which the animal certainly would not understand. We understand the argument that even a weak bill is better than no bill at all. However, we think this is a case where that is perhaps not true, and we had a lively discussion about this issue among our board, and this is sort of where we came down. We think, as is, the bill amounts to an implied statement that just because the exceptions are so broad, we think the bill amounts to an implied statement that devocalizing and decline are generally accepted ways to deal with a dog who barks too much or a cat who scratches too much. We don't think the Oregon legislature should make that statement. With the A5 amendments, we think it would be a good bill. By allowing devocalization and decline only when medically necessary for the animal. So we encourage you to adopt the A5 amendments and to pass the bill in that form. And this is not in my prepared remarks, and it's always a little dangerous when I depart from this, but I wanted to respond to Senator Montes Anderson's question about, you know, can't you just count on the veterinary profession and it being a regulated profession and their sense of ethics and all that, and by analogy to your profession of nursing? And I just wonder if there aren't analogies in most professions where, yes, you rely on the professionalism, of the profession, but there are times in most professions where the legislature steps in and says, we're gonna set a bright line here. And I think in most professions there are analogies where there's a law that says you can't go this far. And I guess I would also point out that I don't think this bill is directed, in my view, it's not directed at veterinarians as much as it's directed at pet owners. And I think, you know, many veterinarians may say this violates my sense of ethics. I'm not gonna do this. Others may feel like this is my customer. As long as it's legal, I need to do what my customer asks. And they may take more of that kind of approach. So I think it's directed more at the pet owner than at the veterinarians. And my final point about that would be, you know, remember also that we're sort of dealing with an animal that doesn't speak for itself and can't give informed consent, and that maybe is a slightly different situation as well. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
May I address Senator Anderson as well? I just wanted to say that as a technician as well as a veterinarian, we take an oath saying that we will not harm an animal. And I feel that declawing and debarking are definitely harming an animal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any questions for this panel?
I have a question.
Senator Olson?
I'm not a kitty owner, but don't kitties like to climb trees? And don't they use those claws in the front to do that? And if they didn't have those, would they could try to climb things, and couldn't they be more susceptible to falling because they don't have the grip that they anticipate they used to have?
Not only climbing trees, but also just jumping down from furniture and, you know, walking. It's part of their balance. It's just as important as their tail.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't have kitties, though. No kitties.
No kitties.
I have 5, and they know I'm here today. So.
I had a quick question.
Oh.
So, I think one of the challenges with this bill is that you have those that there seems to be general agreement among most everybody that decline a cat is an inhumane practice that we don't want to do. where the trick seems to be is how we regulate that and whether or not there should be any discretion left to veterinarians. And putting it in either form makes it very difficult to move the bill. You have almost a completely evenly divided group of people that need to vote on this bill. In the original bill, would the original bill be more acceptable if the language on lines 10 and 11, or no, line 9 was removed, attempts to prevent the animal from destructively using its claws? So that would remove anything related to property and just leave the medical exemption. Would that make it better? I see mixed reviews in the back of the room. I see thumbs up and thumbs down and mixed.
I just can't think of a medical reason to declaw a cat. And someone had mentioned, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, no, but if I'm a practitioner and I want to comply with the law because I'm a law-abiding veterinarian, and I assume most veterinarians are law-abiding and want to comply with the law, if that would make it very clear that you have to be able to justify what that medical need is, if we added that word serious physical health risk, and removed language that pointed towards property. Because that dash 5 amendment also talks about an illness or an injury, so it would just add that physical word in. So we can all think about it, we can talk after hours.
Yeah, and I'm not, so Senator Gelser and members of the committee, so, you know, I would actually need to sit, and I didn't bring my computer up with the actual language of the bill in there, but I would need to actually sit down and look at that specific language to be able to comment, I think, so.
And I think where I'm coming from, having talked to many members of our body about this bill and a lot of people about the bill, it seems like there's a fair amount of comfort around the idea that we shouldn't be amputating cats' paws in order to protect furniture, and more concern around, do veterinarians have the discretion they need to address physical health needs? And if we were to remove that behavioral piece, it would be stronger.
Well, that's essentially what the dash 5 amendments do.
It just phrases it in a different way.
Yes, Senator Gelser, members of the committee, that is in concept what I understood the dash 5s to do, and just to take out the broad behavioral modification exception and leave just the medically necessary, which, and as I stated, we would support the bill with the dash 5s.
All right. Thank you.
As long as you added physical in front of illness.
I think we would support it anyway.
Okay.
But I think... you know, what they were suggesting sounded like to me like a positive change, just responding on the fly, but we would support it with the dash 5s as is. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, next we have Sharon Harmon, Dr. Tom Reck, and would you come back, Representative Barton, too? Well, they're on the way up. I had a technical question about the bill.
See what I can do.
So if the, you know, in Section 1, it's made part of ORS 90.100 to 90.465, which is still the landlord-tenant law. Do we want to keep this in the landlord-tenant section, or might we want to move it to a more animal-friendly part of the statute?
Chair Gelser, again, for the record, Brent Barton, representing House District 40. that is a great catch, and not a purposeful thing, at least on my part. And I would defer to the wisdom of this committee or perhaps legislative council to see. I don't know if they – I just don't know if they thought of that. I'd be happy to take it back and see what the best place in Oregon Revised Statutes is.
Well, and one of the things that's interesting to me up here, just kind of skimming through to look at other regulations that we have in the law around the treatment of animals, dogs, and cats, the only thing that we seem to have in terms of medical practice is the requirement for destroying dogs and cats, and it alarms me to see that there really are no requirements for euthanasia except for how you do that. So it strikes me that even the controversial base bill puts more restrictions on declaw and debark than on euthanasia.
Chair Gelser, it's a very fair point. And as you, you know, the email is sometimes an imperfect medium, to say the least, to get constructive and deliberative dialogue. I think this hearing has already been productive, at least from my sense. And from this, it sounds like a lot of us, opponents and proponents of the bill, like, share the same objective. That is, we dislike decline. The distinction and disagreement is purely tactical. How do we best get there? You know, and you can see the two differences. Right now, it's the Wild West. This provides some regulation, albeit imperfect. The loopholes, I concede, are perhaps greater than give some comfort. It's the best I could do through the House. And I think the status quo is quite manifestly not working. This practice, as is the testimony is, I think, made clear, is simply far too common. And I think it's time to try a different approach. I do not think this will legitimize the practice. At least that's certainly not its intent. I think, to the contrary, this is the beginning. I hope this will be the beginning of the end of that practice. But that's, again, that is a legitimate disagreement that reasonable people can have. I really appreciate your patience in hearing this bill.
And would you be willing to go back and talk to Legislative Council about the right part of statute for this to...
Yes, Chair Gelser.
I'm guessing it's just probably not in landlord-tenant law.
I'll do that today.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, can I ask a representative a question
yes,
also?
Yes, of course.
So this came up a few minutes ago, the question of enforcement. Was there a discussion of that over on the House side? What happens if... if this law is violated?
Chair Gelser and Senator DeDembro, I would not say there was extensive discussion about enforcement, but I think that's always has been implicit. Currently there are guidelines, but there is no enforceability whatsoever. Presumably statute, the violation thereof, is a bigger deal, and most professionals, most people would be more reluctant in that. So perhaps, but in terms of actual enforcement, let me see. I don't believe there's a mechanism in this bill. At least I can't recall one off the top of my head. Having said that, that might be how that would actually work in practice is perhaps not directed, in this case, to the lawyer, but to other professionals in the field. They might be able to answer better than I.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Thank you for your patience.
Should I remain up here, Chair Gelser?
Sure.
Oh, yeah.
We'd like to keep you close.
Senator Gelser, members of the committee, I am Sharon Harmon, and I'm the director of the Oregon Humane Society. You've heard a lot of alphabet soup today, Humane Oregon, Humane Society of the United States. We're the Oregon Humane Society. We're a private, independent Oregon animal welfare organization established in 1868. We've been advocating for animal protection laws since 1880. Myself, I've been before this legislature since 1991, advocating for stronger laws. One thing I know about Oregon is that we are a state of the process of improvement. Few bills I have worked on have ever stayed the same for long. One of the bills that we worked on years ago with the Veterinary Association was to require veterinarians to report animal abuse. It seemed like a no-brainer to us, but the Veterinary Association asked for time to educate their members on what animal abuse was, how to report it, who to report it to. We pulled back from support of that bill, put on conferences, and came back, and we got the bill passed the next year with the support of the veterinarians. Collaboration is really how we've made substantive progress. For instance, in Portland, the Animal Shelter Alliance of Portland is a collaboration of animal shelters who has between their efforts, have the highest save rate in the country. 93% of the animals coming into our shelters leave out the front door alive. Contrast that with Los Angeles, with many of the shelters with a 17% save rate for cats in their shelters. Oregon has a remarkable tradition of working together, and I'd like to think this bill could be one of those stories. For the record, the Oregon Humane Society opposes decline. We oppose decline. Contrary to emails I've received restating our position, I just want to be on the record, the Oregon Humane Society opposes decline. This issue wasn't on the table until March. We had an issue to talk about landlord tenants that got pulled back, and now we're here again with a ban, and I think that just reflects the messy nature of the conversation and the bill referring to one piece of statute, not to the other, is that it's a big issue. there are a lot of people involved. And if 25%, according to the things I learned on the Paw Project's website, if 25% of the cats are declawed, there's a lot of cat owners who aren't aware that declawing is amputation, is a horrific practice. There are veterinarians who offer it as part of a wellness package. Banfield, up until a couple of years ago, the largest veterinary chain in the country, had declawing as part of a cat wellness package. We have education we need to accomplish. We worked with the Veterinary Association in the past, and if they say they would like time to meet with their members and get the education across and come back with a stronger piece of legislation, I would support that effort. With respect to the Dash 5 amendments, I'm concerned that when you've wrapped dogs into it, that now we have a whole group of people who are declawing of dogs and declawing of cats is a different procedure, and declawing of dogs is usually a removal of a single dew claw on each leg as opposed to a wholesale amputation of all front toes. I'm worried that we now get even more voices with even stronger opinions and access to email that we'll bring to the table. We support a ban on declawing and devocalization. I've had a debarked dog that came to the rescue. He just barked more. He just was frankly annoying because he had things to say and we just didn't have to listen to him. But that's our position. We support House Bill 3494A. Of course, we'd like to see it stronger. If the reality is in 2 years we have a ban on declawing, I'm willing to wait 2 years. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Senator Gessler and members of the committee. My name is Tom Keck. I am a mixed animal practitioner from across the river in Dallas. I'm a past president of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association and presently serve on its board of directors. I'm also a past member of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board, having served on it for 9 years. The OVMA finds that House Bill 3494A engrossed reflects the OVMA's policies. But we are opposed to the proposed amendments to the A engrossed bill. The proposed amendment is not an innocent modification. It removes a tool to be used by the client in consultation with their veterinarian to solve problems that have truly no other solution. This amendment should not be added because it removes the doctor-client-patient relationship concerning a procedure that can and is done humanely. The procedure is required by examining board rule to be done under anesthesia and with proper long-term pain control. I've been in the exam room with clients who have tried everything to stop a cat's destructive behavior or are dealing with cat puncture wounds on immunocompromised patients or some very young or very elderly family members with fragile skin. This procedure becomes the only alternative treatment other than removing the cat from the home by surrendering it or making it an outside cat, which is then more endangered in its outside environment and is more dangerous to wildlife. This amendment would outlaw a common procedure of removing dew claws on dogs, a procedure that is a preventative measure in hunting and working dogs to prevent very debilitating dew claw tears while working or hunting. Now, as a final statement, I must state the example of the Keck household, my household. We presently have 5 cats in our house. All are declawed. Also, one of our sons and his wife have 2 cats on the East Coast that I also declawed. These cats were strays brought to the Dallas Animal Clinic. We had 4 small children that were very active around these cats at the times, plus grandparents under chemotherapy. We had to protect them. All of them displayed destructive behavior towards beloved antiques in our homes, so I performed the procedures properly with proper pain control. All 7 cats are doing just fine with no behavior problems or chronic pain. Prior to these cats, we had 3 other beloved cats that have passed on who also had the procedure done. None of them had any negative side effects. So a total of 10 cats in the Keck household with no negative effects. This is to illustrate the procedure can and is done with minimal side effects if done properly. And by the way, the cats climb trees and come down just fine, as long as they have those rear claws. I thank you for your time. I hope you consider the bill and the amendment, and just restate that the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association at this time regards the amendments proposed as not acceptable. And I'm open to questions. Thank you.
I have a question. I think I'm a little bit confused by the testimony, because the intent of the underlying bill, as the sponsors described it, was to really reduce or eliminate mm-hmm. decline in Oregon, and that it would be acceptable to the Oregon Veterinary Association because it's consistent with practice, and that this talks about really reserving it for the most extreme circumstances. Mm-hmm. But you're a veterinarian, and it sounds like every cat that you've had personal contact with has required that.
Not every cat that I've had personal contact with, Senator Gessler. The cats that are in my household. Completely
right.
Different statement.
Right. That's what I meant by, the cats that you have personally cared for, your grandcats, mm-hmm. that they've been declawed. Were they exceptional cats with exceptional needs, or do most cats require decline if they live with children?
They would all be dead right now if they hadn't had the procedure. They were strays that would have been euthanized. That's simple. They were brought to the Dallas Animal Clinic as strays. They were not that adoptable. They had problems. Or they were literally, a couple of them were wild little creatures. And this is the thing. In certain situations, this does prevent euthanasia. It is a procedure that is used to keep a cat in a household where the human-animal bond is very important. I'm all about the human-animal bond. And anything I can do to keep that cat from being sent out of the household because of destructive or inappropriate behavior, I'm all for. I counsel people on how to try to get cats to not scratch furniture. But believe it or not, I don't know what it is about the antiques from my late mother's house that they love to shred versus a scratching post. But they would rather go after the 100-plus-year-old antiques.
And I appreciate that. I think I'm just thrown for a loop, because I think your testimony has underscored what the opponents of the bill have suggested, which is that a lot of cats would be declawed. And I think the way that I read the bill was based on my experience with my veterinarian. Mm-hmm. It's been about a decade ago, four small children. We had this cat, adopted the cat from our Humane Society as a kitten, adorable, spunky little thing, and then it just kind of went nuts, and mm-hmm. it didn't like anybody except for my husband and the rest of it. It would jump up, it would grab my face, the kids had, mm-hmm. you know, scratches up and down their legs.
What happened to the cat, ma'am?
I talked to my veterinarian, mm-hmm. and we tried some behavior modification techniques, and they didn't work, and he suggested that we find another home for the cat, that it wasn't a good match for our family, mm-hmm. and we did find an appropriate right. home. He did well with men and not with children, so he left, and he wasn't euthanized, mm-hmm. and he wasn't declawed, mm-hmm. and our vet kind of walked us through that
right.
process. Declawing never came up, and it was a pretty yeah. extreme circumstance.
I do it every day.
Decline.
I decline to do surgeries every day. There are times where you have to do this.
You decline every day, or you declaw every day?
Decline.
Decline, okay.
Decline. The number of declaws that I do, the number of declaws that I do now versus what I did when I first started in practice 33 years ago is down dramatically because of the education. I agree with that. I agree. But there are situations to keep the human-animal bond together, to keep the cat that is the 93-year-old lady's favorite friend that helps her knit, but when the cat jumps off of her legs, it creates puncture wounds that become infected with MRSA, not from the cat, because she has MRSA. As Senator Manus Anderson can probably tell you, all you need is a wound, and here we go again. You know, to keep that cat from causing that woman's pain and infection, I'll declaw that cat. you know. But I won't declaw it just because I want it declawed.
Okay.
That does not happen. Also, we've heard comments here today about it is a painful procedure, it is a rotten procedure. Yes, it's amputation of the distal part of the paw, or not the paw so much as the claw. And it has to be done right. I served on the examining board for 9 years. We had people that didn't do it right. And it came to the point, it came to the examining board, and we dealt with those people to get them to do it right. Also, pain control has improved dramatically in the last 20 years, even more in the last 10. And we're huge into pain control and veterinary medicine now. And that is one of the major education projects in veterinary medicine is pain control and behavior. These things are being done actively at this time.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions for this panel? Senator Montes Anderson.
Yes. Is it Dr. Keck? Or
correct.
Yes. The licensing board deals with practice standards. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so if there are concerns about a standard of practice, you develop standards or address those? Do you make changes in rule? Or?
Okay. Yes, the changes in rule are done all the time. And, in fact, every year there's two or three rule changes that occur. We didn't used to have even a rule about pain control in the examining board's rules. We do now, and it is required to have pain control for any animal that has surgery. Used to be, when I came out of school, the attitude was, and these were guys with PhDs that were telling us this, you don't give them pain control so they don't do something stupid. Okay, great. Well, we found out that you give pain control, they heal faster, they have better interaction with their owners, they do better. So we use multimodal pain controls, much like my human colleagues do.
Just follow up.
And so if there's a complaint that's brought to your board, what can happen to someone who, say, falls short of appropriate care?
All the way to revocation of a license.
And are they listed on a website or
yes.
anything?
Yes, they're listed on the board website. If a complaint has been filed and found to be a finding of fact that they have violated the Practice Act and its rules, they are listed. Anybody can go to the website and find out which veterinarians have been in trouble.
Thank you.
Senator Dimbro.
Doctor, how do you see, so just following up on that line of conversation, what do you see happening if this bill passes in terms of implementation? And
with or without the amendments?
Well, let's say either way. I mean, what do you see the board doing in order to enforce this?
As the bill is presently written, it's the progression in which the so-called non-enlightened veterinarians will then be educated that you need to do consultation and counseling, and you need to be more involved in this and just not do it because the client is asking you to do it. I will tell you right now, as a member of the board of the OVMA, we will actively educate our members again to how this can be done. If the amendments come, if you stick the amendments on, I believe what we will see, veterinarians, including myself, will not violate the law. There'll be a handful that will. But people, especially of means, that want their cats to have declaws will go to California, Idaho, and Washington. They'll make the trip. I don't know if it will actually decrease the number of cats being declawed. If you truly wanted to decrease the number of cats being declawed, you would have to outlaw the owning of declawed cats, because I think you're still going to see a lot of them because they'll go somewhere else to have it done. Just as you have seen when states or municipalities have made it illegal in an area, people go somewhere else to have it done. I sat next to a veterinarian at a conference from North Hollywood. North Hollywood, California has it illegal to have declawing done? The people come in and, you know, they talk to the veterinarian works with them and says, we want it declawed. He says, I can't do it. Yep. They go to Burbank. They go somewhere else. They get it done. Yeah, you'll have to have a statewide ban to completely eliminate it, but it still gets done. What I do worry about is people doing declaws that are not licensed veterinarians. They somehow get the drugs. I just heard my colleague to my left who has seen this type of stuff happen. They don't know what they're doing, and talk about damage. Non-licensees trying to perform a procedure that takes surgical expertise and proper treatment of the animal afterwards. We see it with dog breeders doing ear crops and doing tail docks. And I get to deal with the problem afterwards when it's a mess. So.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Dr. Question on your cats. You talked about the fact that they came out okay,
mm-hmm.
but you're a doctor and you were there to be able to make sure that their pain meds and all of that stuff was fine. What do you do with the physician that doesn't follow up, or the owner that doesn't follow up with those pain meds that animal needs, and gets into a situation where the cat becomes a biter or urinates around the house? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that?
One thing, all the cats that are declawed at the Dallas Animal Clinic are brought back in at 10 days for rechecks and suture removal at no cost to the client. We're following up. We just don't kick them out the door and say, have a nice day. We follow up. Hey, how are things going? How's the cat doing? Is it using the litter box? Is it running around? How's it, we ask the questions. And that's how it should be done, is the follow-up. A lot of places where there have been problems, there's no follow-up. Also, the cats, when they are done, don't leave the same day they have the procedure done. They don't even leave the next day. We keep them an extra day to make sure that the little rascals are, in good shape, eating, drinking. Actually, we look at seeing how they are walking to make sure that the pain medications are working. Do we need to modify things? So, yes, it takes more work, but we do it right.
Follow up. So what happens to the veterinary clinic that doesn't do it right? What happens to the animal?
I hope the heck they find out, and somebody finds out and makes a complaint to the examining board.
Follow up. Are there any other procedures other than declawing that can be done to prevent the claws from doing the damage?
People will talk about the taping on a protective material or use of soft paws, which you glue on. At some point, those come off. Actually, we have people that want to use soft paws, and they bring them into the clinic, and it takes three people to put them on them because you got the kitty from hell. And in the process, I end up with three staff that are shredded and cut. And you go, okay, fine. We'll do it. But they are not a perfect alternative either. Although, if the people don't want their animal declawed, we're more than happy to try to help them out that way.
Follow up. And this is just for me, but with my Labradors, they know they're going to get their toenails cut, and what mm-hmm. I do is I just kind of grind them off.
Yeah.
The little grinder works really good. Can you do that with a cat? Can you grind that claw down or not?
It really depends on the kitty. I've got a couple of kitties at home that, you want to play with my rear feet, no problem, whatever. I got a couple others that would run for the high hills, but with the proper holding by one of us in the household, we could probably do anything. And then we have the cats from hell that come into the clinic that, like I say, it takes three people to trim their toenails and stuff. And they may be the nicest cats otherwise, but you start doing something like that and they don't like it.
Follow up. You're concerned with the Dash 5s. And is the concern that it doesn't give you large enough parameter to be able to do the procedure if necessary? Is that what it is?
Yes, in that if there is a prohibition, you will have cats that will end up being taken out of households. And that will break the human-animal bond. They're living in a household. The people want them there. The people want that cat. And yet somebody is going to kick them out the door. And in where I live, if we had to kick them out the door, I don't know how long they would live with the coyotes, bobcats, cougars in my neck of the woods where I live north of Rick Rail. I just don't know. They're good at getting away from things, but we've had bobcat problems, and bobcats think a house cat is lunch.
And I, just on that line of question, a question for Ms. Harmon. Do you have people surrendering cats to the shelter that are declawed, still based on their behaviors following a declaw procedure?
Chair Gelter, members of the committee, I looked at our statistics for 2014-2015. We are a shelter that takes in about 6,000 cats a year. There's good at the end of the tunnel here. There really is good news. In 2013, it was 250 cats that were surrendered for behavior reasons related to destruction, and there was about 20 cats that were declawed surrendered. I'm not saying those two are linked, but reason for surrender, homelessness for cats in a shelter is largely product of overpopulation. There's just simply one or too many had a litter, didn't intend, or now they're moving. And with the housing market, what it is, they can't keep cats. But few cats come into our facilities and our coalition's facilities that are already declawed. We try to steer clients towards those animals. And I'm surprised at how few cats come in for behavior reasons. That doesn't mean that there isn't a bunch of cats that are homeless, but for a wide variety of reasons, and we're able to rehome them. It's not all that they come to a shelter and they die. I just want to make sure everybody understands that's not the way it is anymore in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you.
I have a question. I just thought about this, Doctor. I hate to put you on the spot. I've heard many comments that the original bill is just the status quo, allows the vets to keep doing what they want to do, and the Dash 5 kind of crept it down a little bit and made it a little more difficult to do that, which you don't agree with the Dash 5. If the original bill is status quo, why should it pass?
Actually, it's not status quo.
Okay.
It actually says that you need to educate and make sure that the client is educated, which there are veterinarians out there that are probably not doing that.
Okay. Follow up? Somewhere in between the 5 and the original, there's ground that everybody's going to like. Could you recommend what that might be?
Go with the bill as it's been sent to you from the House. Let the OVMA work on this and the Humane Society to try to get veterinarians educated, because we do have veterinarians out there that aren't educated. Just as when we went for more pain control, we had veterinarians that were not educated or didn't choose to be educated. You know, hopefully we can continue, and we are continuing to decrease the number of declawed cats.
What if the bill was amended, just thinking out loud right now, it's the original bill, and then in 2 years, so the original bill then sunsets in 2 years with the Dash 5 going into effect. So it gets to what Ms. Harmon was saying about an outright ban in 2 years. That gives us that date. We would have to come back and pass a new law to stop the full ban from going into effect, but there would still be time if we saw in this two-year period where you're going into that transition, there were a lot of cats that were being surrendered, and then within the current bill immediately going into effect, getting rid of the debarking, because it doesn't seem like there's anybody defending the practice of the debarking.
Nobody's defending the practice of debarking as far as I know, okay? There probably are some veterinarians out there that do. I will not defend it. I find that if you don't have some means for keeping that group of animals in their house, that everything has been done. That's not acceptable. I'm all about the human-animal bond, and I want to keep that animal in its house. I don't want it kicked out the door. I don't want it surrendered. It's a perfectly good cat. So, also the way the proposed amendment, the engrossed amendments here, you know, you've got dog, cat, rabbit,
right, and if we
ferret,
fix the dewclaw,
wow.
The dewclaw part.
Mm-hmm. What was that again?
Well, so in your amendment it is, because where it says you can't declaw a cat, you changed it to you can't declaw an animal, and then we defined animal to include all those people. But but assuming we took care of that part and kind of found that middle ground, is this transition time where we continue to have the conversation. It keeps everybody at the table talking about it moving forward.
I think you would, yes, I think you would be fine to go with the bill as it has come over from the House and come back to visit this in 2 years. Don't go too far now. I think you go too far if you don't think of the alternatives. What can be done here?
Okay. Thank you. But and then just to be crystal clear, in this base bill, mm-hmm. it doesn't sound like anybody would have a problem if it was amended to just outright take the language about debarking that's in the A5, that no exceptions for debarking, just
other than medical.
Other than medical, yeah.
And I'll tell you, I don't know how many medical cases of debarking there are. They're okay. Nada. So I don't think anybody...
Well, cancer. I mean, if they're medically, if there is...
Very, very, very rare in dogs. By the time it becomes apparent, you're in trouble. So...
So. Senator Olson.
Doctor, here we are back again. Is there anything that can be added to the OVM rules that would put a little more teeth, if you will, into this to make it a little more assertive?
Well, the examining board, I'm not on the board at this time, is always open to ideas, no matter if they come from the veterinary community or if they come from the public. Okay? So that's where, if you're going to put regulation in, it should come from, is from the examining board. And the examining board would listen to you, I can speak to that, as to, you know, what that board would do with those proposals or ideas. I can't speak for them. The OVMA board is always into trying to do the right thing for the animals, for humane treatment, and for the human-animal bond. I'll just state it that way. So I can speak only for the OVMA here today.
Madam Chair, would it be possible to get a member of the examining board, at least maybe send them a little email asking a couple questions?
Of course, and you could do that as well and then bring the questions back to us. Would you be willing to do that? And sure. Then if you send them through Cheyenne to go sure. into the record, then we'll be okay with our public meetings law. Yes?
Yes, ma'am.
Sure. So that's it. We're not meeting on Thursday, so we'll be back again on Tuesday.
Good.
I know Senator Cruz is really disappointed. I heard that sigh.
Madam Chair, the committee time is reserved on Thursday in case you have measures to carry over from today.
Right. We are not meeting on Thursday.
If you desire to bring this bill back, you would have to carry over. It would be for the next meeting, even if it was a gaveling amount.
Okay.
You don't currently have anything scheduled for Thursday. But
so we couldn't just carry it over and repost it to
the Tuesday? We could schedule it for the following Tuesday.
The deadline for everything has to be posted for a work session that passed. The deadline was this past Friday.
So we can't
just carrying over if your intent is to.
And even if we canceled, if we put the notice in now that was canceled.
Thursday is not canceled, it's held for any measure you want to carry on.
Right, but could we cancel Thursday and then that automatically makes the next meeting next Tuesday?
I'd have to check on that, but I could.
I think you could carry it over to a date certain.
It has to be to the next available date, and right now, because we've held the date for carryovers, that's Thursday, and then you'd carry it over to Tuesday, and then you'd carry it over.
Do we have to have a quorum to carry it over?
No, you could gavel in and out. You wouldn't even have to open a work session on Thursday to do that, to carry it to the next Tuesday.
Or someone would have to.
Are any of you going to be here on Thursday afternoon?
Sounds like you won't be.
Yeah. My daughter's presenting her bill at her mock Congress.
Oh, we'll take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'll make sure it gets done.
Are there further questions for this panel? And then we can.
I have one further
one. Olson.
Brent, you've listened to all of this. It's your bill. What's your opinion?
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, thank you for the question. You've now heard both sides of this. Welcome to my world of pain. I'm trying to do what's right, getting this through the House. With respect, certain kinds of bills, we have two different chambers and they have different personalities. Certain kinds of bills tend to be easier in the Senate. Sometimes the bills tend to be easier in the House. Animal bills generally tend to be easier in the Senate than the House. And so I am already thinking about, I want to get something that works for everybody here. I still believe there's a middle ground there. getting a more aggressive bill through the House, I think, strikes me as implausible at this time. We haven't had a conference.
Impossible, did you say?
Implausible.
Oh, implausible.
But you never know. And I certainly made various commitments to get this here. Of course, we'll honor those. But we shall see. We haven't had a conference yet this session. Who knows? Potentially, this is will be the first one. But I truly believe that there is still a middle ground there. But you can see, it's trickier than one would think.
Ms. Ron, when people surrender animals, do they always list the reason why? Is that kind of uniform across the state when people surrender to a shelter?
Senator Gelter, members of the committee, it's in our best interest to find out why the current relationship isn't working. And even if they answer moving, if you ask another question, you often find they're keeping two of the cats. But this one, he does something they don't like, or the dog doesn't do whatever. It's in our best interest. Most shelters have an owner questionnaire. But a fair number of cats come in just because they were lost kitties. And they're surrendered to a shelter. Yes, lost. They really were belonging to someone else. But, they're friendly cats. They had a home. Somebody loved them. They loved them back. You haven't asked, but I have the microphone, so I'm going to offer.
Yes.
I do love the notion of a sunset clause. It adds a date certain for consideration. We can always talk in the meantime, but it puts progress in motion. I don't know if that's reasonable in the House. I was thinking about a sunset clause this morning, and I thought maybe that's a path out of this. We agree to do this. It's just in 2 years when the Veterinary Association has had a chance to get their members up to speed.
And I guess the reason I was asking about that surrender, if we sunsetted it and then implemented something that was a fixed up, not dealing with due clause and iguanas, -5 kind of an amendment. We've done other legislation in the past where we've been concerned about an unintended consequence, and it has kind of a repeal that's put into it. Mm-hmm. So if we move to something that was that outright ban and looked at if surrender for behavioral issues related to scratching increased by more than X percent, that it would be remanded or paused to come back. But we would have to actually see that had actually happened, that it increased that number of surrender. But if it was disrupting that human-animal bond...
Senator Gessler, I think you've got a problem with reporting there. Who's going to report it? Who's going to record it? And is there going to be bias in the reporting?
Well, and I wondered about that bias,
yeah.
But that's why I was asking the question. If I take my animal to the shelter,
right.
And I mean, there's all kinds of ways that all sorts of people could game that.
They can manipulate the statistics very nicely on this, one way or the other. Yeah, because every cat that could be surrendered could be because of behavioral reasons to every cat to another shelter. Every cat was just found, you know.
Well, it might be something to just continue some conversations with over the next few days. I mean, I think that is a concern. We don't want cats to die. Mm-hmm. We don't want cats to be separated from their families. Do you think that if more veterinarians were educating, you said that is the change, that there would be education, do you think that would decrease the number of cats declawed?
Yes, it already has. It already has. We're making progress, and the cats that are being declawed, in my opinion, and this is, of course, me at the Dallas Animal Clinic, are animals that we've tried things with or people have tried things with, and sometimes it's also a financial problem here, i.e. the people can't pay for the or they can't pay for because they can't afford the consultation with a behaviorist, or they live in Dallas, Oregon. They can't get to the behavior. So the veterinarian, I admit it, I am not a boarded behaviorist, okay? I do the best I can, and I call behaviorists for advice. But the people are at their wit's end, and it's going to be a choice of the cat goes out the door, the cat goes to the Humane Society, the kids all cry, everybody's mad, all because the cat was shredding things, I declaw the cat in that situation. The cat gets to stay in the house. We do it right. We keep the pain under control. They don't develop the behavior problems because their pain is under control, why they heal, and they stay in the house, and they're the house kitty. the human-animal bond stays together.
Senator Dimbrough.
I'm not sure if this question's been asked this way before, but could would it be appropriate for us to include in this bill a reporting requirement that where the vets would report when they do this, you know, when they declaw? And we could then start to develop some statistics around it, have a real sense of, you know, are the numbers decreasing, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera.
Senator Dimbrough, Senator Gessler, Chair, the reporting idea is a reasonable idea as far as I'm concerned. I've not run that by the OVMA board. My question is, who's going to report and who's going to compile? That's what I we'd have to do.
Martin.
I am sure he has nothing to do on the weekends, and he thinks his inbox is full now. I think that might be a reasonable idea to do, because I would dream that it would have to be reported to either the Veterinary Medical Examining Board or the State Veterinarian's Office. The State Veterinarian's Office doesn't have the finances right now to try to do that. The Examining Board probably would end up hiring at least, you know, a quarter-time person to do those compilings, I would think off the top of my head. And then the other thing is veterinarians would have a problem reporting if they had to report names and addresses of clients. That they value as client privilege. And I think if they just had to report raw data, they'd probably be game for that.
Well, Senator Cruz has not yet had the chance to ask a question.
I thought he was asleep down there.
I'm still here. I was going to suggest, Madam Chair, a non-sunset, and this was what we did, an agreement I reached with Governor Kitzhaber. You remember him? relative to Marine Reserves, rather than put a sunset on it, we put a date certain when the Legislative Assembly had to revisit the issue. And so that's not putting a cliff or anything. It's just saying that a date certain the Legislative Assembly will revisit the issue. You could compel them to come back to the next regular session and report on progress rather than sunsetting. And that, in effect, kind of forces the Legislative Assembly to do something. So it's not a sunset, but I think that's kind of an elegant way that the former governor and I kind of came up with on a couple other things that I think kind of works without being dramatic. So just for consideration. Then one other thing to Representative Barton, the reason we haven't had any conference committees is because the House won't pass any Senate bills. Just thought I'd point that out.
Touche.
I have
all
a
right.
question.
Senator Olson has a question.
Doctor, back to you again. I asked a question earlier about the kitty box syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
You had done this seven procedures on this. What was your view of the kitty box syndrome, that they don't like the kitty box because it hurts their paws?
Well, in animals, and I have treated some animals that were had declaws done at other facilities, and they developed the aversion to the litter box. I'm thinking now off the top of my head, two of those animals had parts of claws left in their toes.
Oh.
Okay. So guess what? I had to go in and fix them. And that happens when somebody isn't meticulous about the procedure. Okay? Went in and fixed them. Proper pain control. Kitty litter problem resolved. Okay? But that's also the reason we recheck these little rascals at about 10 days. We actually physically remove the sutures out of each toe and look at things. Are there adhesions? Are there swellings? Things like that. Yeah. Owner compliance, backing up to another one of your questions, owner compliance on the pain medication can be a problem, just like in humans. Patient compliance can drive you nuts. That's why we have many different modes of getting pain medications into these cats. Liquids, tablets, injectables. You know, we try our darndest. So we ask the people, what can you do? I've actually had people that come in the clinic every day because they can't give I can't give pills. Well, my technicians borrow the cat for 5 seconds and doink, don't worry, pill's done. You know? So it can be done. Or no, I'm not going to pill that cat and here's the injections. You know, and we will do that. So we work hard at that. But you may have also heard something about tenotomy. I think that's a procedure that should never have been done. I had to repair so many of those about 10 years ago.
What is that?
Tenotomy is where you actually cut the tendons that cause the toe to go down, the claw to be extended. Yeah, ugly, especially shag carpet. They get hung up in that. Yeah, there's a lot of screaming. And I ended up having to actually do declaws because that was a thing that some people were saying, here we're going to do this humane procedure, they claimed it was humane, that would allow the cats to keep the claws. It didn't work. So.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Barton and Representative Gomberg, for bringing the bill. We will continue talking about this. I would like to carry it over to our next meeting. Okay, so we'll carry it over till Thursday. We'll have somebody come in. So we're carrying it over to Thursday, but everybody here is interested in it. We are not going to do anything with it on Thursday. We'll gavel and gavel out, so we'll talk about this again next Tuesday, along with unclaimed dead bodies and inclusionary zoning. All right. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on this bill? Seeing none, thank you. And I've seen some people, I think, videotaping. You can get the video online. You can download it, share it with anybody with good audio and video. Just go to the legislative website. And with that, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3494A, and we are adjourned.
In heaven.
And we are adjourned.
In heaven.
House Bill 3494.